Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest in this hour has been a friend for as long as I can remember, but like many friends that we all have, we sometimes have to take a step back and admire what they've done in spite of the fact that you know all their faults. This is John Klink, who is my guest. He is a very distinguished man in the church, especially in the area of social services. He is presently serving as president of the International Catholic Migration Commission, which was founded by Pope Pius XII in 1951, and really serves for the Church as its arm of dealing with migrations of people from one country to another because of war, because of terrorism. We'll talk about that. Prior to becoming president of the International Catholic Migration Commission, John has served as a diplomat for the Holy See at the United Nations, which he did for 16 years, participating in the arduous negotiations at the Cairo Population Conference, the Beijing Women's Conference, and 17 other world forums. We'll go into some other things John Klink has done in just a moment, but first, John, welcome to Church and Culture.
Gil, it's a great pleasure, and I'm glad that our friendship has spanned all of that time frame that you just mentioned.
Yeah, and you don't mind me mentioning that you have faults, actually?
you'll just have to reacquaint me with all of them.
Okay. I'll have to, I mean, on the air, of course, right?
That'll be my penance.
There you go. John, this first thing we should do for our listeners is distinguish between what migration is and what immigration is.
Well, migration is the overall term to describe both immigration and emigration. That is, those coming into, for instance, the United States. And generally, we have had more immigrants than emigrants. Most of the people who have learned about the United States from the get-go wanted to come to the United States and benefit from, you know, the great wonders of the United States, and they would therefore have been emigrants from Italy or Spain or Ireland or wherever. And then, but once they come to our shores, they're immigrants. And migration is the overall term to describe both sides. It also describes those, therefore, who are coming for work, to better their standard of living, to support their family, but also refugees and also anyone really on the move, and that includes potential trafficking victims. And so one of the main things that we are trying to make sure of is that people on the move have protection of their basic human rights, and that they also realize their responsibilities towards wherever it is that they end up emigrating to.
Well, let's talk about the crisis right now in the Middle East, because I know you're dealing with a lot of immigration, that is with an E, out of places like Syria and Iraq. Where are all these people going?
Well, they're not going far. In other words, what has occurred over since the beginning of the Iraqi war is that you had a lot of Iraqi emigrants who needed to get out of Iraq, and those were really refugees, those who have a real documentable fear of persecution. And so it is that definition that we work with in order to make sure that these people are legitimately wanting to leave their country. And
So we're distinguishing between refugees and immigrants.
Refugees are immigrants, but they have a particular right to leave the country and to get into another country because of fear of persecution.
Or death. I mean, outright death.
Yeah. Right.
Now, let's take Syria. Sorry. Where are most of, and I assume you would classify most of these Syrian immigrants as refugees, is that correct?
Yes. And interestingly, beginning with the Iraqi war, many of the Iraqis ended up going to Syria, and they were granted a temporary hospitality in Syria while they were trying to determine if they would be able to go back to Iraq or if they were still needing refugee status and needed to go on to another country. And so the Syrian government allowed them to stay there, and then suddenly, when all of the conflagration happened within Syria, those Iraqi refugees became another part of the problem there. That is to say that they suddenly faced yet another issue wherein their own lives could be in jeopardy, and then they had to decide whether they were going to leave Syria.
So I noticed, John, that you very carefully used the word right to leave a country. And we're going to avoid the controversy that's brewing in Southern California and Texas about the right of the Mexican immigrants, okay? But you are making clear that you're talking about the rights of persecuted groups, actively persecuted, and the rights of those threatened with death, correct?
It's their right to go in, to be welcomed into another country on a permanent basis. For instance, in the United States, there are approximately, in round numbers, around 70,000 that are allowed into the United States on an annual basis as refugees. And so in order to qualify for that status, that's when they have to prove that they have a well-founded fear of persecution. Now, in some countries, people cannot even leave the country without an exit visa, but that's a particular. When I lived in, for instance, Yemen, people, in order to leave the country, even the citizens had to have an exit visa in order to leave the country. But in most free countries, that's not the case. But to go back again to the issue of Syria, what's been happening since the war broke out in Syria, and some people have called it a civil war. The patriarch who visited at our invitation, Patriarch Gregorius III, who is the president of the hierarchy of Syria, says that it is not a civil war. It is a war within Syria of outside forces, and he makes that very clear.
Do you agree with that?
I do. There were certain elements that happened within that war wherein there certainly was an opposition, but that opposition, however, wasn't strong enough to either take over or to withstand the other influx of mercenaries from other countries that were coming in, as we're seeing right now with ISIS and all of these groups that have come in. And the Secretary General of the United Nations identified that there were 2,200 groups at one point that were operating within Syria from the outside.
Wow.
So it isn't just an issue of an opposition to Assad. There's a lot more to it than that. And now that opposition to Assad recognizes that they, even those who really hate the Assad regime, say that the first priority for them is to get rid of ISIS, because ISIS is so devastating and so dangerous.
Explain to our listeners exactly what ISIS is. I have a feeling a lot of people, okay, they recognize that's the crowd that's cutting off the head of British journalists. But, I mean, ISIS is obviously much more than that, and since you deal with this stuff every day, explain what ISIS is for us.
Well, ISIS is, in some ways, an offshoot of the same people who attacked the us on 9/11, and they, however, they, as radical as they are, have indicated that they don't have any close affiliation anymore with ISIS because they're so radical. And the people who are involved in ISIS, their goal is to create a caliphate, that is an Islamic state that would cover all of Iraq and Syria, and that's where the...
Do they have broader desires than that?
Yes, I would say definitely that they do in the longer term, but that's already quite a big nut to crack, and it is already terrifying enough just to see that happening as quickly as it has. And suddenly you had a group that, you know, this administration identified not very long ago as not very dangerous, and suddenly now, in the last CIA report that was released last week, there's over 30,100 troops that are very, very well armed. And the reason that they're well armed is because they've, when they came into Iraq, in around Mosul, there were a group of around 60,000 troops that we had trained, and we had, as the United States, and had.
When did we train them?
During and after the Iraqi war.
And they've been trained by the United States?
Yeah, those were the Iraqi troops. Those were the Iraqi troops. And they, when they saw ISIS, they dropped their weapons.
Right.
And left everything.
Is that because they just didn't feel up to the challenge, or they knew they were up against a more motivated group of people?
It's a very good question. One of the hypotheses is that there were even payments made, you know, to those soldiers to drop their weapons. But no one knows how it was that suddenly these incredibly well-armed soldiers who had United States armaments suddenly just dropped them. And it left the Christians in particular.
So that was 60,000 soldiers dropped their weapons?
Yeah, right.
Where are they now, those 60,000?
Apparently they went back into being civilians.
They just disappeared. Did any of them go over to ISIS? Do we have any evidence of that?
That I don't know.
What would you guess?
I think that most of the ISIS people are that there was a core element, and that they've had a lot of add-ons that have also even come over from the Western countries, and that's a very grave preoccupation of the leaders of the West at this point. You know, I mean, how to deal with that? There, in England, they were even talking about, in Great Britain, they were even talking about not taking away people's passports for fear that they might, I mean, some of the more suspected people, so that they wouldn't be able to emigrate and become terrorists abroad.
Do you have enough experience? Do you have enough experience with that kind of thing to tell our listeners, you know, why is it that middle class young men and women from the United States, from England, and so forth, why do they get involved in this?
I think that there are many youth who want to make a difference in some way in their lives, and if they think that is somehow cool, somehow intriguing, somehow interesting, that they are misled and they go off on a horrible direction. And I think that one of the greatest challenges for Catholics and Christians in general is to make sure that the youth have a different challenge, that they are able to reach out to those who are in need, and that they can be, therefore, as Pope Francis calls it, able to touch the wounds of Christ and get to know Christ as God through helping their fellow man. And that is, that's the great challenge that we have before us in terms of any evangelization of our own, even of our own youth. And, so when you see this, the other day, Archbishop Tomasi, who is the nuncio in Geneva, was talking about this challenge and how these youth want to make a change, but, you know, they are very, misled by these elements. What I find so remarkable is that these elements are so incredibly brutal that they make everything since Genghis Khan look somewhat calm. If you think of even during the Nazi period, the Nazis tried to keep things under wraps, but yeah. These people have no such shame. They're beheading children. They're crucifying men. They're taking women captive. I mean, it's something so barbaric that it scorches the imagination.
I'm talking with John Klink, who is the president of the International Catholic Migration Commission. He has been all over the world on behalf of the Church of the Holy See officially, and has worked in various social services, including Catholic Relief Services. John, you brought up the name Pope Francis, and since you're somebody who goes in and out of Rome with some regularity, of course I'm jealous of that, as you know, and who deals with cardinals and archbishops from around the world, we get a lot of information about Pope Francis. We get a lot of opining this way and that. I trust your judgment. What kind of difference is Pope Francis making in the Catholic Church, in your opinion?
Well, one of the main things that one noticed about him, I happened to be there when he was elected. That is to say, by providence, I walked onto the piazza of San Pietro, and the white smoke came up. And
good timing.
Wait. Yeah, exactly.
You had probably been up all night drinking, knowing you.
And so there's about 50 minutes that you wait, and the plaza started getting fuller and fuller and fuller, and you, at a certain point, you realize that you're having to stand up very straight because you can't stretch out because the plaza was absolutely full, and suddenly the Holy Father came out. And he had a way that just attracted incredible, I don't even know if it would be electrifying attention. He called everyone to silence and to prayer. And the only thing that, despite the fact that there were probably 400,000 people in the piazza at this point, the only thing you could hear were the two fountains.
Wow.
Because of
says a lot for an echoey piazza, right?
It was extraordinary, and the silence was I think exactly what is needed by the newest generation. No one knows silence anymore, and they are called generally to look at videos and get themselves interested in everything that's technological, and everyone is surrounded by noise, and suddenly the Holy Father is calling us in a very deeper sense to prayer. And with all of the crises that have happened over the last 15, 18 months of his pontificate, you can see that he has made a huge difference. By, for instance, with Syria, a year ago, we were in Rome again for another meeting, and he asked for, and it was right at the time when President Obama was considering bombing Syria, and he called for a World Day of Prayer, and all of the bombing of Syria was taken off the table, and everyone said, isn't that coincidence? we who were watching this and participating in the prayer thought, I don't know what you think about coincidence, but I consider it be, you know, a lot of divine providence.
Well, a former prime minister of Israel said that Pope Francis is the only man in the world who can stop a war.
And I think that at this point in time, it is a godsend, you know, for him to do that. So he has a way of communicating that pierces the veil somehow, that people have a general reserve towards organized religion, but somehow he has opened their hearts. When I get in taxi cabs, I talk to taxi drivers who have suddenly decided that they would like to come back to the church.
Wow, really?
And they've been away forever, and they say that this man somehow touches them in a way that they haven't been touched before, and it's really an amazing phenomenon.
Well, when you get to the taxi drivers, especially in Rome, you've gotten to a pretty tough group of people. You work all over the world, and you work in the United States raising money, and you have a very distinguished group of advisors. Would you mind naming them?
No. Our board of governors, which is the governing committee, consists of previously Cardinal Pell was our treasurer, but when the Holy Father called him to be basically the treasurer for the Catholic Church, he had to resign, he felt, as a possible conflict.
And you didn't object?
Oh, I objected, but hey, the Holy Father has a little more influence than I do. And so we had Cardinal Schoenborn of Austria, Cardinal Collins of Canada, of Toronto. We have Cardinal Njue, who's our vice president, who is the Archbishop of Nairobi. We have Cardinal Matiaga, who is the head of the Pope's Group of Eight and the president of Caritas Internationalis. We have Cardinal Marx, who is basically the head of the Vatican Bank, recently made that. And he's actually also the person that Cardinal Pell reports to in a particular way at this point.
John, that's a very distinguished and extremely influential board. How do give all of us a kind of overview of how these cardinals, along with yourself, look at the crisis in both refugee migration and migration itself? I mean, it must be quite a challenge dealing with this in so many places in the world at once.
It is, and one of the most interesting things about let's go to the reason why it is of particular interest to the church, and to key into the theological basis for it, which is the reason that we were founded was at the time that Pius XII founded the ICMC, the International Catholic Migration Commission, he had written an apostolic constitution called the Exiled Family of Nazareth. And that Exiled Family of Nazareth is the Holy Family who had to flee to Egypt. And so that has become the archetype of the Holy Family of Nazareth. It's the archetype, as Pope Pius put it, of every type of refugee,
We forget they were refugees, right?
And it is exactly in that part of the world that this is happening yet again right now. And you think of the Holy Family having to leave in the middle of the night, literally in the middle of the night, and St. Joseph being roused by the angel and saying, get up now and wake your family and leave because of the slaughter of the innocents. And that is the same type of slaughter of innocents that is taking place right now in Syria and Iraq. And to the extent that you have now, for instance, we had this past week, there was a a group that had a meeting of the patriarchs in Washington, D.C., and there were seven or eight patriarchs from the Middle East who were there talking about how they may have some differences in their theological viewpoint, but all are absolutely united in their desire to make sure that human rights are defended and that these people who are left homeless have a way to go back and regroup their lives. Bill, if you think about Syria right now, no one seems to be talking about Syria. There's always a particular focus naturally on the Holy Land of Israel and the Palestinian situation, and most recently about Iraq. But if you look at Syria, before the 3 years ago, the population was approximately 24 million. Right now, there are almost 10 million people who are displaced from Syria, almost half of the population.
And where are they?
6.5 million of those people are within Syria, homeless, going from place to place. Then there are, by Christmas, it is estimated that there will be 5 million Syrians alone as refugees who have gone to Lebanon, to Jordan, to Turkey, and to Egypt.
Do they have much trouble getting into these countries?
They don't have great trouble getting into, Turkey they would have to have some kind of paperwork in order to get in there. But for instance, Lebanon, it has traditionally been a fairly porous border, and the people are very well, very closely related in many ways, familially. But if you can think of the debilitating effect that this is going to have on the Middle East, if you think of
totally destabilizing, John Klink, let's take just a short break. Everybody hang with us. This is a very important story, and we'll be right back.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
We sometimes hear that we're a resurrection people, but what does that mean? It means that we can look forward to entering heaven, which has been opened to us through Jesus' death and resurrection. In his letters, Paul tells us we are citizens of heaven, and Matthew's gospel makes it clear Jesus is the King of the heavenly kingdom. Revelation shows us the worship we will experience when we get there, and how we will participate in the wedding banquet of the Lamb. This future reality is prophesied in Genesis, its meaning unfolded through the Bible, and we get to begin to participate in it through our sacraments even today. Let us journey to our heavenly home with joy and hope, strengthened by knowledge of our goal and our status as citizens of heaven. To learn more about our journey to heaven, visit the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan on Facebook or at cbsmich.org.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In the 4th century, catechumens at the Easter Vigil would process through their First Communion chanting Psalm 23. It turns out Psalm 23 is actually a catechesis of the gateway sacraments of baptism, confirmation, and Eucharist. He leads me beside still waters. We emerge from the still waters of baptism as new creations. You prepare a table before me. Once we are baptized into the church, the Lord lays out the banquet of the Eucharist to nourish us. And you anoint my head with oil. In confirmation, our heads are anointed with oil, and we are forever sealed and identified with the cross of Jesus. And finally, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. The gateway sacraments we have received encourage us all the days of our lives to follow the path of holiness towards our Father's house.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
I'm back with John Klink, president of the International Catholic Migration Commission, talking about how the Middle East continues to destabilize with millions of people being displaced with inside Syria, inside Iraq, and millions trying to get out of the country and will continue to try to get out of the country. John, you remember that some years ago you and I collaborated on an event in Washington, D.C. During the Bush years in which we tried to bring the persecution of Iraqi Christians to more people's attention. And there were others. I mean, there were a lot of articles at the time about not just the persecution, but the violence and death and takeover of Christian cities in northern Iraq. It seems like only now the United States has taken, the government anyway, has taken a serious look at this problem, is trying to do something about it. Why did it take so long?
Well, I think that there was that over extended reaction from the Iraqi war. People did not want to face the fact that this situation had not simply, wasn't just simply going to go away. And you had a situation, for instance, wherein there was a stability that had been enforced, whether good or bad, by Saddam Hussein, and then it dissipated, and everybody kept hoping that the new government would be able to take hold and manage. But by virtue of what we've seen recently in terms of, for instance, the 60,000 soldiers just dropping their weapons and moving on and allowing ISIS to come in, that doesn't bode well. And you know, how do you finally get this the restabilization back? But one of the things that we were talking about is that issue of how destabilizing this is going to be for the entire region if you have, for instance, in Lebanon, you have cities that have doubled in size in the last 2 years.
Wow.
You have the fourth largest city in Jordan is a tent city.
How big is that? How big is that city?
It's about 100,000 to 120,000.
And who's paying for all that?
It's not paying enough. It is the UN is trying to cope with all of this, but the last figures that I heard was that they had maybe 20% of the budget that they needed in order to deal with this. I mean, I always use the example, think of an extended family dinner, and if every relative you ever knew came over for dinner at Christmas and then never left, how do you deal with that? Right?
Maybe before they killed each other?
Yeah.
So when people think about United Nations and all the horrible things it's done in terms of family and life issues, there is something to say for having a United Nations, after all.
There is no other entity that is capable of trying to cope with these massive numbers, and I mean throughout the world. And so, you know, my hat goes off to them. And in these instances, it is imperative that the governments kick in and really help them to do the
our government, you're saying?
Our government and other governments.
But how much does the Catholic Church actually put in terms of resources into places like Jordan?
Well, we, for instance, our major field of operation is for Catholic Relief Services, our boots on the ground are all in the almost, I'd say about 80% in the Middle East. And so we have people in Jordan, we have people in Turkey, we have people in Lebanon, and we even have people in Damascus. And the other organizations such as Caritas, the local Caritas agencies are, you know, stretched very thin. And so we partner up with them in order to try to accomplish as much as we possibly can. But if you have that many people, the main focus has to be almost, it's a triage wherein
Yes. You
look at the most vulnerable people and you try to help them. But if we don't get the resources we need and we have to go out to the American people and ask for their generosity. And
well, let's take a pause here and ask, if somebody wants to donate to help you at the International Catholic Migration Commission. Is there a website? Is there someplace they can go to donate?
Yeah, the easiest thing to remember is ICanMakeAChange.org, and that is it's using our acronym of ICMC.
Very clever.
And putting it into the vernacular of young people who need to feel that they can
say it again. You got to say it a couple of times.
ICanMakeAChange.org.
Aren't you glad I gave you that idea? ICanMakeAChange.org. ICanMakeAChange.org. I mean, it's the stories you're telling are, and from the perspective you're telling them, are, I mean, they're so moving, and they make any little complaint I have about my life completely, irrelevant. And I'm sure that people listening to this program feel the same way. How do these people individually, because you know them, how do they cope within themselves with having to be uprooted and live under a tent?
And in order to really understand how difficult it is, these are people who are middle-class people. When I used to work with, for instance, the Cambodians, the Khmers, in the 1970s and 80s, they were basically a very poor farmer, hand-to-mouth type of existence. These are people who have had a livelihood, who have had a middle-class existence, and suddenly overnight they're out in living in tents in the middle of the desert. And there was one story of this woman who was telling us, she said, "I cannot go to sleep at night for fear that I will wake and find that my children have frozen to death." And that is the image that strikes my heart every time I think, as you said, if we have some minor problems in our lives, but if you think of a woman, for instance, who doesn't know if her husband is still alive, because, I mean, it's sort of like it's reminiscent of our Civil War when men would go off and the women didn't know what was going to happen, if their husband was alive or dead. That's the situation with so many women now who are forced into being single mothers taking care of their children, and in refugee camps like that, or in the other place that they do go is they're sometimes they're welcomed into the cities. They become urban refugees, but again, they don't have heaters, they came with the clothes on their back. They have to have some way of paying a rent. They have to have some way of feeding their children. And those are the types of things that the church needs to reach out. And that's why ICMC and ICanMakeAChange.org is really trying to assist them in every way possible.
Are these refugee camps like the ones that the Palestinians ended up in? Are they going to become permanent like they did for the Palestinians?
That's my great, great fear. And that's why whatever can be done has to be done to reestablish the civilization that took place in Syria for thousands of years.
How can they go back, though?
If the Arabs themselves have to begin to cope with this, first of all, and they need to be emboldened by the pressure of the United States. Last week, the patriarchs met with President Obama, and he recognized the fact that the Christians at the moment, for better or for worse, are being protected by the Assad regime, the Assad government. And if the stability is totally erased, then what will happen to everyone? So there has to be some solution whereby the people of the Middle East themselves get together and do their own peace conference. And
I think it's extremely it's extremely saddening to me that meeting that you referenced of the patriarchs with the president was covered in the conservative press, and we're talking from Fox News down, as a meeting of the president with terrorist sympathizers, with you know, that were basically on the side of ISIS. And I heard no, I saw no reports on what the substance of that meeting was. Did you?
The substance was that the patriarchs presented to the president I think it was a five-point plan whereby they asked for them, for all of the countries around to try to prevent all of these individual groups from coming in and taking over, and for presenting some sort of opportunity, economic opportunity for the people once the conflagration stops to be able to go back to their countries.
But how do you do that without military intervention, John?
Well, right now they are talking, for instance, at least they are going in and I don't know if they're going to do boots on the ground, but they certainly do need to stop ISIS in whatever way possible.
But there's no way to stop ISIS, from my vantage point, without military force.
I think that everybody is pretty much in agreement with that, right?
Wait, is Pope Francis in agreement with that?
You know, I really don't know what specifically he said. He prays for peace because he's not a man of war. But I think that if you're looking at situations in which children are being beheaded, that sort of criminality has to be stopped. I mean, it just has to be stopped. You just can't allow
And what you're saying, it has to be stopped even if military forces have to be put on the ground to stop it. Now, I agree with you. But I think Pope Francis does.
I don't know about military forces on the ground. I just don't know that yet.
You can't take out 30,000 highly trained terrorists from the air. But anyway, we're not military experts, so we'll avoid that. And then maybe somebody will email me. I'll give my email at the end of the program and enlighten me on the subject, because I find it very frustrating when the United States militarily does all of these sort of very limited engagements and ends up with American deaths and no real solution to the problem. Go ahead.
But to return to the accusations that the people that met with the president,
well, they're Hezbollah sympathizers, is what was said.
These are the patriarchs of the Middle East. I mean, they're the heads of the Catholic Church within the Middle East. They are the ones who are trying to protect their people.
Did you see the stories that I'm referencing?
I didn't see the stories. I heard, for instance, Senator Cruz came and gave an intervention which was not particularly appreciated at the time.
What happened in the media story subsequently was Senator Ted Cruz of Texas gets booed off the stage for talking about the defense of Israel. Subsequently, these patriarchs go to the White House, one of whom has a close relationship to Hezbollah. So President Obama is therefore welcoming these terrorist sympathizers while Senator Cruz gets booed off the stage by the same crowd.
The commonality, the unity of all of those patriarchs, including the cardinal Cardinal Sandri, who came over from Rome, and including the nuncio, was in order to make very clear that human rights have to be respected and that you cannot have children being beheaded and men being crucified and women being taken off in slave camps, and that's not debatable. It is just simply not debatable.
And I think everyone agrees with you. The question becomes, is that the United States' job or is it the job of a coalition?
It's the job of a coalition, but you have to have leadership in order to get the coalition together, as we've witnessed in the past.
And no one, even Cameron, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, whose own journalists are being beheaded, he hasn't really tried to establish a leadership position in the response to that kind of heinous violence. Am I right or am I wrong?
I haven't seen in the last 2 days what they've been saying, because it's a very developing story. When I was in Rome, I read that Cameron had come out very clearly and said this is the greatest challenge we've
had. Yeah, he came out and talked.
Modern time.
He came out and talked about it.
And then I understood also that the Australians were sending in troops.
Well, you know, if anybody's going to do something about it, it's going to be the Aussies. God bless them. There are people that understand human nature, if I might put it that way, and they're close enough to their own migration experience, right? Because Australia, as a continent, as a country, is a continent, a country of migrants to a large extent.
Just like the United States.
Yeah, well, we're too far away from it, I guess. But it's my observation, and we've known each other a long time. We've been to the Middle East together. That you just can't get a sense of what's going on over there without having visited. Is that too harsh a comment to make?
I mean
harsh on the people who pontificate from afar but have never been there, I guess is what I'm saying.
And I think that once you are there, you understand in particular it is our heritage. I'm not Lebanese and I'm not Syrian, but it is our heritage as Christians. It's our heritage as Jews. It's our heritage as Arabs. It is our heritage in every way you can think of, because of the monotheistic religions that's their cradle. That's where it all happened.
And when you stand on the temple, we've stood on the Temple Mount together in Jerusalem, and it really comes home to you, you know, that this is the place where Jews, Christians, and Muslims all come together. By the way, I want to ask you a question. I was at lunch yesterday with friends, and very devout Catholics, the kind of Catholics you and I should hang out with more. And one of them said, you know, brought up the Muslims and being all in favor of this kind of terrorism. And I said, no, not all Muslims are like that at all. In fact, it's only a minority. And she said, oh, well, then those who aren't in favor of this are not good Muslims. If they were good Muslims, they would be in favor of this. And I told her that she was wrong on this point. How do you deal, certainly you deal in your comings and goings, with this attitude toward Muslims? How do you handle it?
I think, for instance, there's a great danger right now for this to be seen as a Muslim versus Christian conflagration, and that is not the case. It is a Muslim versus Muslim. It is a Muslim. The segment is a sliver. The ISIS is a sliver of the Muslim population, and that population if you're talking 30,100 people, they are very well armed, but that is a minuscule number of Muslims who are supporting this, but they have suddenly gained an incredible amount of firepower, literally and figuratively. They have incredible resources at their disposal for a variety of reasons, including the fact that they got so many of our armaments that were left behind. They robbed the bank that had $400 million in it. They have oil reserves that should be, we should figure out a way not to let them use those oil reserves to have that money blocked. But this is for centuries and centuries, the Muslims and the Christians got along in Syria.
And Jordan. They still get along in Jordan.
Absolutely. And they, for instance, in Syria, where this conflagration is particularly happening, the patriarch would speak in the mosque, the Grand Mufti would come and speak in the Catholic Church. So it is, isn't the case. You remember the old, that horrible saying that in the old West, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. I mean, that's just, it is not the case. I mean, there are great Muslims and.
Well, in this conversation, it went on to be said, well, why aren't we hearing from the so-called moderate Muslims who are opposed to this kind of terrorism? Why aren't we hearing from them? Now, I see objections, protests, condemnations by prominent imams and Muslims. But on the other hand, I don't hear them from extremely prominent ones who can get their names in the newspaper. Is that a fair observation?
I know that the Holy Father has been working particularly closely with the head of Al-Azhar University and some of the other imams on human trafficking. And I honestly, I've been traveling so much that I'm not as abreast as I should be as to who has said what. But I know that many of the Muslims have come out, but more and more should come out because these people that are being attacked, they're blowing up mosques. They're bulldozing the tombs of prophets, and those are prophets that we have in common. They're not simply Christian prophets or Jewish prophets. So this is a common problem that we need to approach and show that human rights have an absolute value that everyone has to support, and we cannot start throwing accusations at one another like, unfortunately, Senator Cruz did the other day, because we need to have a commonality here. We need to have unity, and we need to save these people's lives before it's too late. And we
John, has the Arab League taken a stance on this kind of terrorism?
You know, I honestly don't know because I've been.
We don't hear from them. We don't. The Arab League was set up, you know, decades ago, in order to be a political voice for the Arab countries, but they don't. You don't hear much, if anything, from them anymore. And I think they're obviously a resource that could be tapped. What about Egypt? Is any of the leadership in Egypt commented on these kinds of acts?
I honestly don't know.
My lunch partner from yesterday has a point that if we're not able to name the most any prominent Muslim leaders who've come out and said absolutely inhuman and we have to band together and stop it, then and somehow that needs to happen.
My understanding is that Senator Kerry has been traveling in the region and trying to make to get a coalition together so that this is not, you know, a single-handed thing on the part of the Americans, but it is that sort of leadership that has been sorely needed and is, you know, finally coming to a head, and I hope that it has a real effect. The other thing is that I would ask everyone to do what Pope Francis has asked us to do, and that is seriously pray for mm-hmm. these people.
And for you and for your work with the International Catholic Migration Commission. Name the website one more time where people can come and make a donation.
It's icanmakeachange.org.
That's wonderful.
Icanmakeachange.org.
And John Klink, good friend, servant of the church, long-suffering. defender of human rights. Thank you for being my guest on Church and Culture today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and we unite in prayer on this one. God bless.
Well, we'll have you back on the show soon.
Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
The annual Oktoberfest at historic St. Joseph Church next to Eastern Market in Detroit is September 27th and 28th. Authentic German food and drink, arts and crafts booths, church tours, and more. Saturday Mass will begin at 4 p.m., followed by the festival at 9 p.m., with the Killarney Creek Band and swing dancing and lessons. Sunday Mass is at 11:30 a.m., celebrated in German by Archbishop Vigneron. A 3 p.m. choral festival with regional choirs and German music and dancers. Oktoberfest ends at 7 p.m.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, when the church spread throughout the world, it took on the character of various cultures. This helps to explain the nuances and tensions on the world scene between East and West.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. The kingdom of heaven is theirs. Those who work for justice will always be persecuted by those who foster injustice. Those who work to preserve the most basic justice, that is, protecting the right to life, are persecuted all the time by both believers and non-believers. They are accused of having a narrow focus and a lack of compassion, while in reality, they are focused on the most broad-based right of all and have compassion for the most vulnerable of all. Because they know this, pro-life activists can be at peace in the midst of the persecution. They need not be distracted, nor should they ever doubt themselves. The ridicule they endure is a promised blessing from above, the blessing of suffering for doing what is right. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
I'm bored. There's nothing to do. Have you heard that one? Isn't it amazing that our children, who live in probably the most active culture in the history of mankind, who probably experience more options in their young childhood than any kids have ever experienced since the beginning of time, probably more than most kids say, I'm bored. Do you have to listen to I'm bored?
No.
If you're bored of hearing it, you have several options. One, you could have a house rule. Anytime you say I'm bored, you go over to the chore jar and you pull out a chore and do it. One mother said every time she heard I'm bored, she made her son sit down and write about all the nice things in his life that he could do. Another mother said, if you're bored, I have some things for you to do. I'm bored is really an expression of discontent. It really says, I don't have enough. I want more. Maybe it says, Mom, you're on earth by God to entertain me, to make sure that my life is not boring. If you want to have a rule in your home that you don't want to hear I'm bored, have it. Tell your children this summer, there will be no saying I'm bored, or things will happen so that you will not be bored, and you won't like the things that'll happen to not be bored because you'll be tired of being bored because your boredom will lead to tiredness and end. I'm bored with this whole commentary. I'm Dr. Ray.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by our day sponsor. In memory of his godly wife,